Thank you, Chris. And yes, I'd like to extend also my welcome to you all. It's actually a real delight to be here. I spent spent most of yesterday in London already, so I've had the opportunity to connect with, and some of you are here today that I met with yesterday, and just start to feel into what it's like to live in London, and feel the experience. And Chris was saying when we arrive, it's good to kind of have a chance to metabolise the experience of being on the tube and just kind of land. So this day we'll be using as a topic of reflection and contemplation the theme of death, of mortality, and what that can mean for us. And in terms of practice, in terms of spiritual practice, particularly for those of you who have a orientation towards meditation, and that's, I imagine, a good number of you, if not all of you, we can sometimes think of the reflective or contemplative or even imaginative and evocative qualities and capacities of our mind as somewhat problematic, as being sort of the thing that gets in the way when we're trying to be calm and still and quiet and peaceful. In the same way, we can imagine that the sounds of the road or the workers outside might be in the way. And for today, I'd like to invite you to contemplate or to engage in a process of contemplation that will involve a certain amount of reflective, evocative, you could say imaginative, turning of the mind, the heart, turning of one's life to look in a particular way at what's here. And in doing so, the intention isn't to try and necessarily deliver a body of information to you which you know, faithfully record and review on regular occasions thereafter. It will be recorded for listening to again. My invitation would be really more to allow what's offered to be an invitation to be touched or to explore what's the impact, what's the effect of what will be spoken, what may be shared by others, what may be sensed for yourself. And so with that, I'm assuming, again, I think I've mentioned it already, but you all know what the theme for the day is. It's quite possible sometimes just to come along and then, well, what are we doing today? But I guess that hasn't happened on this occasion. And just in terms of the form, my intention for this day is that we will have some time for some reflection and discussion together, but there's a real value, I feel, in maintaining a primary sort of environment of silence together for a good part of what we'll do. Now, this is perhaps going to be a little different than the silence that might be found in a sort of a cloister far removed from any activity or a sort of a retreat centre out in the country. And it's also not the silence in which one is trying to somehow bring to a closure or to a cessation that the activity of the mind, or the heart, in fact, and not so much quieting the mind, but creating an environment or inviting an environment in which the deeper reflective capacity and the deeper wisdom of our life can inform the activity of our hearts and minds, and not feel in conflict with that at all. So just also, so I can just have a sense, my intention was that there would be quite a few periods of meditation in this day. It's a way of both landing with ourselves and engaging with the topic from a place of where we are, being present, or more and more fully present, and as a vehicle for exploring what it is to be here. And so I just want to check, are there anyone, and is there, and it's fine if that's the case, if there's anyone here who hasn't had experience with silent meditation before? Just being in silence and connecting with your immediate experience, feeling into, getting to know what that is. Okay, it's okay if you were to tell me that that was the case. You wouldn't be in trouble. But it's just useful for me to know if that's so. Okay, great. And that really fits with the intention of the day, because my plan isn't to give a great amount of meditation instruction. But I would like us to begin just now by, first of all, taking a moment to contemplate or to reflect for yourself, what is it that interested you? What is it that drew you to come along today? There may be something clear, specific and particular for you, something in your life or in your experience that resonated with the theme, the topic, contemplating or the contemplation of death, of mortality. There may be just an interest or a curiosity in the topic that doesn't seem to be a particular direct relevance to anything going on at the moment. Maybe just the opportunity to come and be together in a contemplative environment is what drew one, as much as the topic itself. And whatever that is, just letting yourself be in touch with that. And if you don't have a sense of that, that's okay too. But just something got you here. And maybe it was just, oh well, I'll go along. Why not? And within whatever that specific might be, I imagine there's going to be some sense of interest. Some sense of being drawn, being called, being moved in some way. To come and spend a day engaged in spiritual practice and contemplation rather than, you know, getting a head start on one's Christmas shopping. So as I mentioned, we'll spend a good part of today in silence, but the intention is not to be on our own, to be with ourselves but also together, and not just in this group. I'll say more about that, but I'd invite you, you're not required to, but I invite you just now to take a moment and look around. Not like you have to make eye contact or have a deep and meaningful experience with anyone. It's not prohibited either, but just notice that there's this group of human beings, people, perhaps friends, perhaps strangers. And what it's like just to be sitting here right now amongst a group of people, living beings, and noticing that it's sometimes something of a smile might come to the face as we do that, or maybe not. Noticing that sometimes when others look at us, a smile might come to their face. Or maybe not. That latter being a little worrying. How the experience of being with others can be both quite delightful and also challenging. Scary. And really for this day, I'd like to invite you to consider that we share something here. Profound, precious, mysterious, and temporary. And it's called being alive. Profound, precious, mysterious, sometimes scary and confusing too. And temporary. And when I say that, just notice how you respond. It doesn't have to be that those words have some great effect on you or in you. Just notice how you respond. There's an interest. If there's a slight hesitation in taking that in, or a sense of, you know, so what does that mean? All those interesting or fancy words. It's really easy to imagine we know what it means to be alive, but particularly if we spent a lot of time exploring and investigating it in the context of spiritual practice and teachings. And wonderful if that's the case. But I think there's something really powerful in acknowledging to ourselves that there may be more to know, to understand, and to let in about what it means to be alive. And really the theme for today, the contemplation of death, is essentially equally the contemplation of life, but seen from a very particular perspective. And, it's really one of the most frequently referred to and used topics that the Buddha invited his followers to engage with as a way of really orienting their practice and their life in an authentic way. We as a culture and a society have become remarkably good at it. I'm not telling you something you don't know, but I'm just naming it. We've become really good at tidying away the things that scare us, or the things that unsettle us, the things that allow us to forget both the remarkable and the temporary nature of the fact that we're here. We tend to tidy them away into places where you don't really have to go unless you really want to or have to. Of course, we all have to go there one day. So that it doesn't impact us, it doesn't unsettle us, it doesn't affect us. And from the point of view, spiritual practice, and really with my intention for this day, it's to allow ourselves to be affected. Maybe touched, maybe unsettled a little. But an unsettling that's really about shaking up our certain views and ideas and habits that can allow them to settle in perhaps a deeper and more true relationship to our life. So we have this human body. We here. It's what we use for meditation. It's really useful, I hope you've noticed. Because the mind, it seems, can go anywhere really quickly, and often it does. Yeah, we all know that. But the body's always here, at least for a while. But in terms of our meditation practice, it's here. Something we can refer to, we can connect with, we can relate to. And the body is the framework in which we really begin this contemplation, because this body is born. It comes into existence. It arises due to the conditions amongst which, including the coming together of parents, or at least of a sperm and an egg. And out of that, the birth of this life, of this body. And this body goes through an inevitable journey of growth, of aging, at times sickness, and having been born, ultimately coming to death. And it's something we all know. It's not unusual. In fact, I'm sure some of you have spent time contemplating this. I've spent time contemplating this. And still, sometimes it seems really easy to not remember or to not allow that fact to inform one's life, to inform how one is living and one's choices. So we try and hide these things away from us because they unsettle us, because they perhaps would invite us to question what we give our time and energy to. When the retreat centre in Devon, which I'm connected with and a number of you know, Gaia House, was looking to move from a smaller premises, a vicarage, to the current premises, which was an old convent, one of the interesting features about the place when it was put up for sale was that it had a cemetery on the grounds of the nuns who'd lived in the convent. It had been a sort of a hospice, really, for many of them coming back from missionary work. And together with Gaya House as our sort of Dharma centre being interested, there was also an old people's home and a holiday sort of home, not home, like a holiday camp type of business, were interested in the place. And for the nuns, it was really important that they gave this, or that they sold this place, to someone who would respect and appreciate the cemetery and take care of it. Now, for the old people's home and for the holiday camp, having a cemetery in the middle of your grounds was a really bad thing. This was not something they were keen on, because despite the obvious relevance of the topic to an old people's home, it's not what you want parked beside a place where old people are. In our culture, it seems to be that's the case anyway. And likewise, if you're going on holiday with your kids and you want to have fun, the last thing you want to do is have this central event being, or central location of a place that's reminding us of something that we tend to want to go on holiday and not think about. And in some ways, life can become a whole process of going on holiday and not thinking about that. And I mean thinking about it in terms of just thinking, but about really feeling, what's the impact? What's the significance of this? And of course, for Gaya House, for a Dharma centre, for us, it was like, great, wonderful, we get our own graveyard. You know? That you know, adds value to the real estate from our point of view. And that's a really different approach, isn't it? It's like, what would it be to say, rather than, I don't want to be exposed to those things that make me question, or make me feel something that's a bit unsettling, or not quite, you know, it's not about my grocery list for shopping that I need to do, or, you know, sorting out what's going to happen to any number of social events I've got planned in my life, which are probably too many. It's like, oh, just a moment, what's important here? And so, from a practitioner's point of view, from my point of view, from the Dharma teachings, it's like, it's a blessing to come into contact with that which reminds us of what's really important. And so one can make the intention to really see, okay, where is this being spoken to me? Or where can I hear this? Rather than, how can I not listen to this? How can I avoid seeing it? How can I sweep all the sick and the aged and the dying and the dead away to the periphery of consciousness, which culturally is what happens in technological societies. In a pre-technological environment society, that's not the case. Sickness and death happens in the midst of the community. We sometimes think that's a bit sort of gross. And yet gross in and of itself isn't a bad thing. Much of what our body does is kind of gross, in fact. You know, toilets are locked away in small rooms. But actually, we all go to them every day. And we wanted to say it's a gross thing, but it's not. It's just what happens. You know, gosh, he's got really unsavoury now. I don't normally talk about that. You know, but there it is. If we look at what we kind of hide away from, why do we do that? I mean, we don't hide away from plates of food, but within a few hours, what they've become, we hide away from. We'll keep hidden away. We celebrate birth and think, wow, how wonderful. And the Buddha said, well, why do you get so excited about birth and so upset about death? Because you could get upset when someone's born, because being born, they're going to die. Now, I'm not saying we need to get upset, but to see how we do that, how we kind of separate out what is a process. And food is a kind of an example. There's food, there's eating, there's nourishment, and there's excrement. There's birth, there's life, there's joy, there's pain, there's learning and growth and challenge, and there's death. What if we included all of that more fully? So we were recently donated a skeleton. Gaya House actually has the skeleton of a person who lived in India in the latter part of the 19th century, we think. So it's just about over 100 years old, the skeleton. Looking pretty healthy, mostly all there. And it's really, again, for us to be offered a skeleton, for most of it was like, great. And for a number of people, it was like, just a moment, that'll scare people away. We can't have that. People come in here and they don't expect to see a skeleton. I mean, you know, if I could have brought it with me, I'd have loved to have it sitting here. But I didn't need to, really, because actually there's 40 or 50 skeletons sitting in this room. Really. And the point of setting a skeleton here would simply be to remind us that, yeah, we've got one of those, and one day it won't be on the inside. It'll be on the outside. Whether in a whole form or in the form of small crumbs, according to how we choose to go at that time. And so I can talk about this, and it can seem like kind of light or even humorous, and there's something about it that is, because there's, I think, a relief in just facing it and saying, yes, it's like this. I feel and find there's a relief, and that sometimes brings a lightness or a laughter that's not about dismissing it, that's not about sort of trivialising or making it somehow comical. It's not about slipping away from the impact, the import, like the weightiness, the gravitas of the topic, but by seeing that turning towards it isn't something about being sort of gloomy, morose, depressed and miserable, although that may be how we respond to the topic, that's okay. But it's like there's something very alive in the topic for me. I find myself, when I talk about it, experiencing the sense of life more fully. And when I talk with others about it, when I encounter it, and it's all around us. It's all around us. And it happens. It just keeps on happening. It just keeps on happening. And I got an email message from a friend of a woman who sat retreats with me, saying that she just received a diagnosis of an extremely aggressive cancer in the brain. It was the brain, but anyway, it was extremely aggressive cancer, and she said, you know, are you going to record the teaching today? I'd like to hear it, but I can't come. I can't make it there. And a sense of, wow. And I just realized she'll be listening to this. And yet, you know, it's like it happens to us when it happens to us. It happens to us. Sometimes it seems to be happening to someone else. And again, what's that like? What's that like for us, just here and now, to acknowledge? I remember a couple I knew and was very fond of. It was some years ago now. They were in their, I think, early 30s. And one day, they had a young child, and one day the guy, John, just a blood vessel in his brain burst and he just died. Bam! Completely healthy, and he was gone in minutes. Just like that. It was like no indicator, no history, no, at least that I'm aware of, family predisposition. Just a small little organic tube in this rather sensitive and precious and crucial organ burst. How many of us have had a blood vessel get cut and burst or bleed? Just that simple experience of bleeding happening in the wrong place. And he was dead and gone. Never said goodbye to his wife or his daughter, nor they to him. Maybe some of us have had that experience, and someone that we loved was just gone. Yeah, maybe we have. There's a vulnerability in our life. There's a vulnerability in what it means to be alive. But contemplating this topic, the turning our attention to this, we feel it, we sense it. When I was talking about the importance of our body, this body, for all our care and effort to take care of it, is a remarkably complex and complicated system that depends on a vast numbers, hundreds and thousands of things working. And any one of them, when it stops working, the whole thing can stop. The whole thing can. Okay, I'll try and speak louder. How, anyone else need me to? And there's also, if I'm not quite, I'm just noticing it's sort of quite a spread to get the voice to go in both directions. But please tell me, thank you, Danielle, if I need to. So there's this soft human body, this vulnerable human existence that we share together, that we're in. And yet, though we all know it, though it's so true, though it's, no one here is going to argue against what's being said, I imagine, in terms of the fact of the reality of this. Somehow, we don't always take it on. And there's this wonderful teaching in the Bhagavad Gita, where Arjuna, who's the hero and in a way the main character, is in his chariot, and the charioteer, Krishna, who's representing wisdom in the conversation. And there's lots of interesting teaching in this, but Arjuna asks Krishna, he says, in your vast, and Krishna, obviously one of the gods, in that model or that story, in your vast vision of the cosmos, the universe, what is the greatest miracle that you see? And Krishna responds, he said, that although human beings see around them others dying, they somehow believe it will not happen to themselves. This is the greatest miracle. It's remarkable, isn't it, how true that can be? And I say this not as a judgment of the fact that we can all do that, not to somehow blame ourselves for it, but to see how remarkable. Like, it seems like you'd have to really try hard to convince yourself and to believe and to take it for real that, no, it's not going to happen to me. And yet, so much of our life we live as though that's the case. As if this is going to go on forever. As if there's going to be another breath coming in when this one's gone out. Anyone who ever got bored with their breathing? Anyone who ever thought that thought about my hopeful winter holiday in the, wherever, the sun or the snow, was more interesting? Or the potential stress and pressure of Christmas shopping and all the relatives was more scary and challenging than what's happening right now as I'm sitting here breathing? In a certain way, we've lost touch with something, haven't we, when that happens? We've lost touch with something. And spiritual practice is really about allowing ourselves to come more fully and consciously into touch, into contact with that, and allow it to affect us, to allow our vulnerability and the way in which it can affect us to become more conscious. And so the first and perhaps primary and most important, not necessarily most important, but certainly a primary and important element of the contemplation of death is that it asks us not to take our life for granted. It asks us to look and see, what am I doing with this time? What am I doing with this time? This precious opportunity I have. Am I giving myself to that in my life which I feel is most important? There's a lapel button I once saw. It was actually stuck on someone's tea cosy. And it said, enjoy life. This is not a rehearsal. This is not a rehearsal. This is our life. And so to live it consciously, to be fully present in it, to make the effort to be awake, which is very much at the foundation of meditation and spiritual practice, is not coming out of a sense of I should because it'll be good for me, or, you know, I'd really like to get better at meditation and, you know, then I could feel a bit more comfortable and my mind at least would be less stressed and pressured and possibly even, you know, I'd start to feel a bit wiser and more compassionate, all of which is wonderful and precious and important, yes. But what is it to be here? To be alive at all? Are we interested to understand this and to practice to be awake, to be present? Because we start to sense the preciousness. The preciousness that's totally dependent on or in relationship to the transiency of this existence. If it was forever, how would we call it precious? How would we know its value if it was forever? It's precisely because it's not. It's precisely because of our vulnerability that we feel the preciousness of it. And that preciousness isn't something necessarily in relationship to its duration. Like the longer I get, the more precious it is. We think, you know, I want to live longer. We kind of hope and extend with some, you know, sense of maybe positive thought that the range of years we might have. Though, of course, every day, every year, in fact, every minute and second, you know, it's going to be that much shorter. We don't know how long, but we can be sure it's going to be that much shorter from here on in. It keeps going in that direction. Quote comes from. Do not ask for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. Sorry? I know. And, you know, there was a time when maybe that was part of why it happened every hour. Maybe it's reminding us. Not just to be mindful, but to mark our mortality. And sometimes, even though it might feel like it's pretty tough, pretty difficult, and it can be, this experience of being alive, challenging, scary, overwhelming at times, I think when we hold it in this way, somehow its value to us, or its meaningfulness, its preciousness, can start to inform us more fully and clearly what it is that matters here. What it is that's really important to us. The preciousness of existence is not about its duration or its extension in time, which is limited for sure. But it's about its very fact that it's happening at all, that it is happening. And at a monastery in Sussex, Chitta Viveka, Chitta's Buddhist monastery as it's known, where I have good fortune to have spent some time periods with the community there of monks and nuns. In the gardens, in the grounds, there's a little plaque, I guess plaque on a stick underneath a small tree. And on it there's a quote. It says, the cherry blossoms cover the hillsides for just a few days. Any longer, and we would not treasure them so. And with it there's a name, it says Little Sam, and there's a date, a single date. And when I go and stand there and look, as I I do whenever I go, and even when I speak about it, is that sense of the preciousness of a life that was just for one day. That was not less precious or meaningful to those who knew little Sam, I'm guessing from what they wrote, than the preciousness or the meaningfulness of a life lived 70 or more years. The cherry trees, the cherry blossoms cover the hillside for just a few days. Any longer, and we would not value them so. Again, that sense of transience is connected to our sense of value, of preciousness. And if we feel that preciousness, if we sense that, then I think we're more in contact with what's really important for us. It gives us perspective on the things we get irritated by. You know, the things that are annoying, frustrating, unfair, not as I wish they should be, not as in fact they should be objectively, but I know how it should be and they're not. All those things, sometimes held in the light of this reflection, we can find a greater degree of softness and acceptance in ourselves for our own limitations, for those of others. So there's a quote that I'd like to share from, it's from the teachings of Don Juan by Carlos Castaneda, and he talks about living with death as your advisor. He says, and Don Juan is a shaman, he says, death is your eternal companion. It is always the hunter, and it is always to your left at arm's length. It has always been watching and always will, until the day it taps you. How can you feel so important when you know that your death is stalking you? The thing to do when you are impatient is to turn to your left and ask advice from your death. An immense amount of pettiness is dropped if your death makes a gesture to you, or if you catch a glimpse of it. Or if you just have the feeling that your companion is there, watching you. The fact of your death is never pressed far enough. It is the only wise advisor you have. And whenever you feel that everything is going wrong and that you are about to be annihilated, turn to your death and ask if that is so. Your death will tell you that you're wrong. Your death will tell you that nothing really matters outside of its touch. Your death will tell you, I haven't touched you yet. To ask death's advice is to drop the cursed pettiness that belongs to men and women who live their lives as if death will never tap them. The fact of our death. It's not a thing that might happen. It's in fact the only certainty in this existence. There is nothing else we can guarantee going forward. Nothing else is for sure. And yet, even this, we do not know when. Or how. And so there's this teaching. It's formulated specifically in this way in the Zen tradition, but expressing very much what the Buddha invited himself of his followers. He says, death is certain. The time of death is uncertain. In this situation, what should I do? Or one could say that, what makes sense in this situation where the only thing guaranteed is that at some unknown point it stops?